We start having a quick introduction round through the sites, and then I will introduce Jeremy. So UIC, would you like to start again? Just your name again, and maybe your research interest, and then FIDIS, and okay, could we just make a quick round of introduction?
Hi, my name is Wen Zhenli, and I'm a researcher at the UIC Learning Science Research Institute. And my research interest is math education, and I study how pre-service teachers pre-service teachers' knowledge about geometric transformations.
Hi, Elaine Klein here at the University of Washington. I'm a second year PhD student. I'm interested in biology education, thinking about undergrad education as well as how graduate students develop identities as educators.
I'm Philip Bell, faculty here at the Life Center and in the College of Ed Learning Sciences program. And my research group generally studies how, why, and where people learn about the science and what the implications are for teaching. And we have a third person who just walked in.
My name is Gabriel De Los Angeles, second year doc underneath Megan Bang, studying play specifically in areas of role play and development in that area.
And one person off screen.
Hank Clark, staff. Hello, Jeremy. Hello, everyone.
Hello, everyone. This is the LMU from Munich. My name is Daniel, and I'm a first year PhD student within the learning sciences, interested into scientific argumentation within the realms of mathematics. And with me there are 5 second year master's students.
Ladies first, or do you want me to go? I guess I'm the most ladylike. Hello, my name's Heinrich. I'm a master's student in learning sciences, interested in collaborative learning and leadership, and analyzing big data to come up with better theories, let's put it that way.
My name is Heather. I'm a second year master's student in the learning sciences, and I'm interested in computer supported collaborative learning and potentially applying that to organizational settings.
Hi, my name is Blake. I'm also a master's student here. My interests are in computer and internet technologies. That's why I'm interested in this presentation.
Hello, everybody. My name is Vasilaki Katerina, and I am the third semester of our master as well. And I'm interested in communities of learners, communities of practice, and social network analysis.
Hi, my name is Evgenia. I'm also a master's student here, and I'm interested in collaborative learning and helps all of us.
Hi, Mimi Becker from Utah State University, Instructional Technology and Learning Sciences. There we go. And I have a student here.
Hello, my name is Ming. I'm the third year PhD student from Instructional Technology and Learning Sciences.
Hi, this is Friday is also from LMU in Munich. I'm a doctoral student here. I didn't do the sound check, so I hope you can hear me. And I'm looking forward to the session today.
Okay, so thanks for the introduction. Let me introduce our speaker today, Jeremy Rochelle. And Jeremy is currently the director of the Center for Technology in Learning at the SRI International in Stanford. His research examines the design and classroom use of innovations that enhance learning of complex and conceptually difficult ideas in mathematics and science. And I think this is also already the core of the paper that we read today and that we will discuss today. He really focused on, was dealing with several technologies, but two of them were really in the core, the envisioning machine and later SimCalc. And he has explored how computer-based representations can make the mathematics of change and physics of motions, which are, of course, related, accessible to more students than these domains are originally accessible for. Two of his overarching themes of his work are the study of collaborative learning, and this is what many of the of today's participants are also interested in, and the appropriate use of advanced and emerging technologies, and especially like the term, which is a very, very open term, the appropriate use, so what that is, such as component software or wireless handhelds in education. And I looked at the stations of his career, and well, he started his career as a research intern. Some of you are also do research internships currently at Xerox Park in Palo Alto, and he became a research scientist in the Institute of for Research on Learning, a quite famous institute at Palo Alto. Then he became a senior software designer at the University of Massachusetts and a senior cognitive scientist at SRI International Menlo Park, and where he's now a center director of the center that I mentioned. But earlier even he started his undergraduate education in computer science, so he received a bachelor's degree in computer science. And then for graduate studies, he went to the University of California at Berkeley and did his master's and PhD in the area of education with the focus on mathematics, science, and technology. Well, I think all of us and many more know several of his papers, but maybe one of the most famous is the one that we will be discussing today. And Jeremy, we are looking forward to hear what you have to tell us about this paper.
Thanks, Frank. It's a great introduction, and great to see some old friends and meet all the new people on the conversation today. So I had in mind to break this into four segments. And first, just to share a little bit about the history of what was happening at the time this paper, Learning by Collaborating, where did it come out of? What was going on at the time? How did I come to write it? And then, of course, we should talk a little bit about the content of the paper. That'd be segment two. And I would like to talk a little bit about the paper as a piece of rhetoric. It was a real struggle to get this written and published, and I want to talk a little bit about that because I think maybe there's some lessons in there for the graduate students and postdocs in the room. And then finally, I thought it would be fun to talk about, well, what's changed since 1992? Is this still relevant? Where is the field going? What are similar things that need to be done today that you might all be working on? And so that's my overall plan. And I guess people can't really talk back, but I do have the text window open, the chat window, that is. So I'm going to talk for a few minutes, but really if at any time you want to say, give me some feedback, go ahead and write in the chat window. Okay, and Frank has his hand.
Sorry, just what I wanted to tell, I mean, people could just raise hands and you see it, and if you think it's the right place, then you could just let the questions be also posed on video. But the plan sounds good, I agree with that. So.
Sounds good, and we'll try to, Frank also said this works better if we try to be interactive. So for each of the four segments, I have a question or a prompt for thinking that I'll suggest, and I guess groups will discuss at their own tables perhaps, and then let me know what they're talking about, or however Frank suggests we do it, I'll be open to. Okay, so part one, let's talk a little bit about the history of this. So I went to Berkeley, which had a new program, which today we would say is a learning sciences program. Phil and Mimi were there too, slightly later. And you know, it was all very new to be doing cognition and education. We were in a school of education. It was all very new. And I was a student of Andy DeSessa's. And Andy, as some of you may have read or know, worked a lot on conceptual change in physics education. And I'll come back to in a bit some of what he thought was really important, but I was doing my dissertation with Andy. However, I also, at the same time, needed a summer job because I needed to make some money. And Jim Guarino was briefly at Berkeley before he went to Stanford. And he said, well, you know, why don't you get a job at Xerox PARC for the summer? And the group at Xerox PARC eventually became the Institute for Research and Learning. And if you want to learn about IRL, I found they actually have a Wikipedia entry about IRL, which is not bad. So I ended up spending some time at IRL, which was really at the beginning of situated cognition. And it was an amazing time to have that opportunity to be there. We had Jean Lave and Etienne Wenger, and we had Jim Guarino, and we had John Seely Brown, and a number of other people. Roy P. was in the mix, Bill Clancy, and they were all really arguing with each other about what this new idea of situated learning would be, what's the role of social interaction in learning. And I was kind of a fly on the wall, kind of taking that all in. And then what happened was, back at Berkeley, my dissertation committee could not decide what a dissertation should look like in this new department. And I couldn't figure out, I didn't have a go forward while they were arguing. And so after a while I said, well, guys, I'm going to go work at IRL for a year and take the year and figure it out. And when you know what a dissertation is, I'd be happy to come here back here and be a student. Because, you know, just sitting around watching you guys debate what a dissertation should be isn't for me. So I actually went and spent a lot more time at IRL and really worked on collaborative learning with Stephanie Teasley a whole bit. There's another famous paper with Stephanie that is often more read in Europe than in the US on joint problem solving. And so I ended up working there. Then I went back to Berkeley and I did my dissertation on cognition. But in a funny way, this paper, Learning by Collaborating, Convergent Conceptual Change, is the dissertation I wish I had written. It's what I most valued at the time, and it was really work that played between the Berkeley context and the IRL context, and tried to bring them together. And I do think this is a thing that I still see happens, that sometimes when big ideas are being discussed by senior people, like I am now, often it's the graduate students who can find the synergies between the ideas that are going on. They're more able to move between the worlds than more established people who do what they do. And so I felt really lucky to have those opportunities to move between those two places. So what were the ideas that were going on? Because I think this paper really comes out of the Berkeley ideas and the IRL ideas put together. So on the Berkeley front, the hot issue of the time was conceptual change. And so that's how do kids go from more naive or more basic concepts of physics and mathematics and other topics to more advanced ones. And the big debate at the time was between a view, the most simple view was that, you know, students are blank slates and we're just going to pour knowledge into their head. And everyone knew that was wrong. But improvement number one was the discovery of misconceptions. So students are not blank slates. They have these things called misconceptions. Let's eliminate those and then we can pour knowledge into their head. More or less. Painting it bluntly. And Andy DeSessa had a very different view, the knowledge in pieces view, that said, well, these misconceptions aren't good or bad, it's more that they're formative. And we have to look at how can advanced knowledge be built from the knowledge students already have, which is not bad knowledge, but it's maybe not correctly applied as scientific knowledge. And so that was a core thing I was working with that you may see now in this paper, and you may be able to think about how is it positioning knowledge students already have as a resource that they could use to build new knowledge. Okay, so now let's switch over to what's going on at IRL, where people are really involved in social aspects and situated aspects of learning. And at IRL, we're reading about how science works. We're reading Bruno Latour about how science is socially constructed between people. And actually, you can see in the references the kind of people we're reading, a lot about pragmatics. People were very fascinated with Shegloff and with Harvey Sachs, and people who look at how work gets done socially. How do you actually, not social as an abstraction, but how do people really do social things and get something accomplished in that social universe? And not necessarily in that social conversation, thinking about something like conceptual change. They were thinking about how you agree on where to go to dinner, and all kinds of other things you may need to agree upon. And we were looking at lots of video analysis, and the way IRL got its work done was to sit around a big table together and every week watch a new video from somebody else's research, and then debate and discuss what we all saw going on in that video. And so that's what that context was about, and about sort of pragmatics of social interaction and how that might lead us to a new concept of learning. And so in that context, I met with Stephanie Teasley, who is a student coming from Pittsburgh, and we analyzed videos together obsessively, which I happen to have already for my dissertation. So Carol and Dana were the two students here. I had already collected the data for my dissertation, not thinking to analyze it as collaboration at all. In fact, I had only thought that the thing at the time was to do a protocol analysis. So you would interview a student as they think out loud, and you would keep prompting them to think out loud. And I thought I didn't want to constantly be asking students to think out loud. So why not put two students together and they'll talk to each other and I'll analyze what they say to each other. But I was still thinking about it when I collected the data as individual cognition. But then Stephanie and I started to analyze this data as social cognition, and she was really coming from yet a third perspective, which was intersubjectivity and in child development, in Piaget, in Vygotsky. And so that was yet a third perspective entering the work. And so that's where this work came out of, is my attempting to bridge the two different places. Berkeley is about an hour from where IRL was in Palo Alto, where I now am located. And I would go back and forth. And this paper was my attempt to bridge what was going on in the cognitive science side on the one hand, and in the pragmatics and social discourse side on the other hand, making use of data that I already had collected for my dissertation and now was reanalyzing in a different way with a new layer that I had not originally contemplated that I was going to work on. Okay, so I think that's enough introductory talk about where this comes from, and I think we should have a little bit of an interactive time here. And I thought a good place to start, I thought two prompts that might be good places for discussion for us to talk about. And one is a framing concept that was very important, not resolved in the field. And it has to do with two ways of looking at collaboration. In one way of looking at collaboration, the purpose of collaboration is to produce more effectively individual learning outcomes. But the only thing that is real in the extreme version of this view is what individuals do and what individuals know. And the collaboration is just important for its effect in changing the knowledge for the individual. So that's point of view one. And point of view two, which was being pressed hard on at IRL at the time, is the only thing that's real is social. Who cares what's in people's heads? And we can't see what's in their heads anyway. The only thing we can do is probe them, and the best way to understand what somebody's thinking is to talk with them. So that the thing that is really real is social engagement around scientific concepts. And so that's what we want to build up in children and in learners, is their ability to construct ideas together socially. And so those are two very different views of, you know, what the paper is about. Is it about what happened for Carol and Dana as individuals, or is what we're talking about what they learned to do together, or what they were able to do together? And so why don't we discuss that? So at this point, what I had imagined is that the different groups would discuss at their table and maybe some share some thoughts back. But if it's better to use the queue, I'm fine with that. Frank, you have the most experience with this format, so I leave it to you to help me facilitate.
I think it's a good idea. So if the groups would discuss the different perspectives and their view on these two different perspectives, or if there even are three perspectives, they are already discussing. The individuals do things that they should do a kind of internalized discussion called reflection, and maybe we give all these groups and individuals just a couple of minutes, say 3-4 minutes, and then we would like to hear what the results are.
So maybe another, maybe we wait another minute or two. I'll just be quiet. But then in a minute or two, it would be great if groups would maybe put themselves in the queue to be the next speaker. Okay, so maybe now it's a good time to volunteer for the queue and to hear what some of the groups are thinking.
Hi, we're at the University of Washington. We were thinking about the fact that in the Everyday and Science Technology group, we're kind of both and, so it's not necessarily the only individual cognition or only social cognition, but that individuals are located within structures of social practice. So thinking about Dreyer, meaning on that to build ways of thinking about how people learn in lots of different contexts.
And then we were also just thinking about how a lot of our design work is situated in places that require individuals to perform on tasks in ways to which they're accountable. Like, so these are testing moments. These are, you know, other, you know, moments where you get called on in class to, you know, engage in certain kinds of things. That kind of foregrounds that individual layer a little bit more than we might choose to otherwise, given how project-based work often is a collaborative, you know, social unit analysis. And then we have somebody in an Indigenous pedagogies class that was trying to frame a reaction to the discussion as well. Do you want to try to summarize that?
Best I can. Can you guys? Oh, yeah. So one of the questions that we're still wrestling with is the whole idea of the individual as an individual unit, or the individual as a collective, if that makes sense. The social is the individual. The individual is the social. What do you think?
They are both.
Yeah, they're the same.
In the aspect of certainly that the individual is a collection of things that their history and standpoint lead up to where they are. They are the sum of all of their parents and grandparents' interactions that lead up to what they got put into them.
Yeah.
So we'll wrap up there.
Okay, it's you now.
I don't know, we had some questions, especially on the social collaborative side and measuring data. I come from a business background, and a lot of the collaborative tools that are used in business for projects and how knowledge stores are created or analyzed. And these are sophisticated network analysis, how networks change if people collaborate. Is this being done in the learning sciences at all? And how is basically this social element and the change of these structures that are created, how are they measured in the learning sciences? Because most of the research we see are fairly short experiments. I'm just curious what's happening on the side of analyzing bigger data and these social interactions. And on the individual side, it's quite easy to measure the data, but this social collaborative element, this network that gets created and changed, how is that analyzed?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, certainly social network analysis was not something that we had available at that time, 20 years ago. I'd love to have other people react to the question as well. I certainly know of evaluations, for example, Phil would know this, about the Life Center, where they are looking at how a large research center, how its collaborative work is manifest in the change in a social network. Maybe Phil would like to comment a little on it.
Well, we do have a larger, have a growing number of people tapping into social network analysis to try to understand those broader flows of information or activity. And so that, I wouldn't say that we have it worked out yet, but I know that we have graduate students off taking those courses, trying to kind of frame questions around that work. I know Bill Penuel and others have historically done, been doing work for the last 5-6 years, kind of understanding school district improvement through a social network analysis kind of methodology. And so I think it's totally on the trend line to figure out these larger collectives of kind of change in activity.
I completely agree. I just wanted to add that the group in Munich also has a couple of research projects using social network analysis in the analysis of communities of practice. And I think what the challenge is what Jeremy pointed to at the very beginning. So Social network analysis typically is used to analyze interaction and not cognition. And how to combine the analysis of interaction with the analysis of cognition in the framework of participation, for example, but that links also to knowledge and to concepts. I think this is something that is really challenging and really missing. My real contribution to that discussion would be a bit still another one. So I heard from the University of Washington that this question of the unit of analysis, and I put it very simply, it's individual or the group. You had a different take on that a little bit, also with the transitions and so on. But I think maybe the question is twofold. It has an A part and a B part. So the one question is, what is to be learned? Is that an individual skill, let's say, or is that a social skill? So is it a skill to collaborate with others, or is it a problem-solving strategy or something like that? That is one question. And I think we have a lot of research dealing with both of these. The other thing is, where do you look for the representation of this knowledge and skills? So do you only look in the social realm? So what Jeremy said from the Palo Alto time, very early time in the Learning Institute there, only looking at the social and only looking at the activity. So knowledge is residing in the activity. So my position on that would be there are important and substantial points that are really represented in the human mind between the years, so to speak, because humans are the main players in these social activities. And I think a difficult and a challenging question currently is, if you think about, things like collective intentionality. So you have you develop a joint plan, or in your studies, Jeremy, you develop joint standards for progressing your inquiry, and you agree on these. I think it is extremely hard to identify and to analyze these processes that go beyond pure individual skills and also go beyond pure collaboration skills. There's something else. There's a joint intention behind that. That is extremely difficult to analyze, and I don't think we have many examples of that. And using social network analysis might be a way. Maybe I spoke too long. Sorry for that.
Well, I think that's all good. Does anyone want to also get in before we move on to the next phase? Does anyone else have an idea they want to share? Just raise your cue and I'll switch over to you. Raise your hand, I guess, is what I mean.
Hi, I just wanted to add to the discussion that in one of our projects here, we have been looking at gesture as a means of, like in a collaborative setting, using gesture as a means of both sharing ideas as well as switching roles between people when they are working on a shared task. We are still at a very nascent stage of analysis, but I was just thinking, like when you were talking about various ways of analyzing collaboration or various ways of understanding collaboration, that's something which has come up as a very important aspect in our project. So I just wanted to add that.
Absolutely. So one thing I think we learn here across all the different sites who are speaking is that, you know, choosing the unit of analysis and understanding the interplay between knowledge and individual and knowledge as social is a very live issue 20 years later, and still is a challenge for learning scientists to separate and relate. And that's the point. It's a good point to stop this phase of the conversation, I think. One thing I'd also exercise for further work in this area is to think about what your definition of collaboration is. And Stephanie Teasley and I worked on one definition that still is sometimes used today. And at least it makes a difference between, on the one hand, people working together cooperatively, where each does part of the work, but they do parts of the work separately, and then the pieces of work add up to a larger whole, versus work that is really aimed at creating shared knowledge, which we termed collaborative, where the goal is to work together to construct knowledge in common. And that was our focus. And it can be different from the division of labor sense of things. I think today that's often called transactive, where we're building on each other's ideas. Frank, you can jump in and help me out if you don't agree. That's basically transactive is the current term for that. That's also an important thing, I think, when you're doing work in this area, to really take some time to decide what your definition of collaborative learning is and what it is you're saying, because the terms are slippery. And if we go over to the Silicon Valley environment that I live in now, a lot of products like Facebook are trying to claim they support collaborative learning when all they really mean is they let people communicate with each other, which is a very different thing. Again, an infrastructure for communication, a classroom is also an infrastructure for communication, but the fact of a classroom existing doesn't mean that collaborative learning is occurring. So it's another reason why it's important, is because the term's being watered down by a marketing use of collaborative learning. Okay, enough of that. Let's talk about the paper itself and what it sets out to do. And so I think I will try to give a little summary of 20 years later, in my mind, what is this paper about, and then leave some work for the groups to do in helping me decide what the paper is about as well. And so the puzzle, the thing at the heart of this paper, was on the one hand conceptual change. And so I was very interested in how students come to learn physics, in particular the physics of velocity and acceleration. And this is very hard for students because they initially tend to think that a force or an acceleration should immediately and directly change the motion. So if I have here my little box, I'm trying to get it in the camera, and I push on it, it goes in the direction I push, and so the force directly changes the motion. And that's how it feels to us in everyday life. Whereas in physics, we have the idea of the force causes an acceleration, and the acceleration changes the velocity, and the velocity is the speed of that motion. So it's a less direct and more mediated concept of force or acceleration being mediated by velocity and then becoming what happens in the motion. And this is hard for students. And I knew it was hard because I was studying the envisioning machine, and I was studying lots of students, not just Carol and Dana, and I could see how long it took them and that not all students succeeded in what I was pursuing at the time, is basically a discovery learning task. I gave them the simulation and said, figure it out. And I didn't give them much instruction at all, and saw what kinds of problems they had and who succeeded, and when they succeeded, how did they do it? And at the same time, they were doing it socially, and through the work at IRL, that work again was focused on what are people accomplishing? How do social accomplishments work? How do people do work socially? And so I tried to put the two together. And so on the page 237 I'm on, I hope you have the paper handy, came my proposal for this, that on the cognitive side are the first two bullets. One thing I observe very profoundly is that experts would look at the envisioning machine and would immediately see this in a physics way, in a scientific way. They would say, oh yes, that's what I see in my mind when I do physics. But students would come to it and they would see a bunch of dots and circles and arrows, and they didn't know what to focus on. You'll see on figure one on page 240, there are dots, trace dots. Experts would see the distance between the trace dots telling you something about velocity. And students wouldn't even notice that there were dots. They thought that was just a line that happened to be drawn in a dotted style, but they wouldn't notice the meaning for the spacing between the dots. So the first thing I proposed is that students have to construct what it is they are paying attention to and what features exist in the world for them. And this relates to cognitive science research at the time on deep features and surface features that, for example, Jill Larkin was doing. Then the second point, so I argued that students have to do that. That part of what's going on is students have to agree on what they're looking at and which things are worth looking at and what they mean when you look at them. And then the second part of the cognitive process goes back to the Andy de Sessa knowledge in pieces. What is it the students have as a resource that they can use to build a new idea? And I said it's metaphors, which is it's just another way of saying P-PRIMS, if you know Andy de Sessa's term. P-PRIMS is a little more specific, but it's jargon. So I meant the same thing, metaphors. And in particular, a lot of students use the metaphor of pulling. And the way they constructed an understanding of acceleration is to think about the acceleration vector pulling and moving the velocity vector, and the velocity vector pulling or moving the particle along, which is in fact why I have the acceleration vector hanging on the end there. But one thing we see in this paper across the episodes is that pulling itself is not a sufficient metaphor to construct the idea. So students brought many metaphors together. And another was the idea of a hinge. So they saw that, there's my velocity vector. Let's see, can I get in the camera? There's my velocity vector. And there's my acceleration vector. And they saw this hinging. The acceleration vector's hinging and it's pulling to change that vector. And so there was multiple metaphors that, as you watch episode by episode, come together in the paper to start to form something that's a better approximation to the scientific idea. And so that's the process that I was trying to describe here, is how drawing out the features of the situation and using metaphors could lead to crafting an idea. And I don't think it's in this paper, but I was very influenced at the time by some of the writings of Einstein, who talked about some of the work. Well, it is in here indirectly through the work of like Nancy Nersessian. Oh yeah, Einstein is cited on page 236, and Lightman on it's also, they're all cited in the middle of page 236, where they talked about their own processes of scientific discovery as a play of metaphors in the mind and of learning to see the world differently. So I thought this had some validity because of what the real scientists did. And so what I tried to do episode by episode was trace those two things happening. Then on the other hand, we have parts 3 and 4, which are the social parts, and have to do with how is this happening with people together. And so the first part is the basic thing people do when they're talking is they display some understanding by what they say and what they gesture. And then the other person may confirm that, I agree in some sense or another, or I don't agree and I want to fix what I think is wrong with your statement. And so one of the things I still remember from that time, I can almost put myself back in IRL, is the idea that people interrupt to repair. That if you're going along saying something, we will wait for the other person to make the mistake, and then as soon as possible after they make the mistake, we'll interrupt then, so as to locate the piece of the utterance that we think needs repair. And so that process of interrupting each other, an interruption is a move that has a direct effect on the process of shaping knowledge. And so that is some of there wasn't conventions about in learning sciences as to how to write transcripts yet, but we adopted some of the conversation analytic techniques, looking, well, that's not a good example because it's not a repair. But anyway, to try to indicate exactly where talk is occurring by the bracket notation, so we could see how people's talk was relating to each other. And then the fourth part, I'm going to leave as a puzzle for you for discussion to think a little bit about this idea of a standard of evidence. And the basic thing about it is, if I say something now, you can all nod your head and say yes. But does that mean that we really understand each other? Is nodding our head yes understanding? And so if it's not, what would count as evidence? Now this is not, let me go slowly here. There's evidence for us as scientists, but in the first instance here, I'm concerned of evidence from Carol or Dana's perspective. What should Dana take as evidence that Carol understands her? And what should Carol take as evidence that Dana understands her? In other words, what is available in what they're doing with each other that lets them know that they really understand each other? And so why don't I again pause there and leave room for a little discussion. And I think what would be great would be is if groups can see some of the evidence for mutual understanding where you believe Carol has a right to decide Dana is understanding her, or Dana has a right for Carol to decide, oh, she's understanding me. Where do you see that happening in the discourse where you think it's reasonable for them to make those conclusions about each other? Because I think that's core to how this paper is working. So again, I'm going to turn it over to you and hope you'll look at the paper and try to pull out a couple moments, then we'll go around and have people talk about the moments of the discourse they picked out that they thought were good evidence for the students understanding each other. And if you didn't understand what I just asked you to do, raise your hand immediately and I'll try to clarify the suggestion. But if not, I'm going to let you work for a couple minutes. Ah, okay, so here we go.
Yeah, hi. Well, as far as I understand, that's, maybe I'm wrong, but what you're doing there is pretty much like a game of representations. You have something like internal and very subjective representations of what science is that is constructed around some representations that are socially shared or shared by a community. So you're trying to contrast if people that has not contact with those representations can understand them. Because when you say like, they say that it's a line, but a line drawing one style, but then it's not because it's a vector. What you're saying is like they don't share that code, but then when people talk together, then they are in the same field, because practically you're saying you cannot judge the representation of the other because you really don't know what is going in the mind of the other. So it's like a game of internal representations, as far as I see. Do I understand you correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. There's two, as you're indicating, there's two levels of problem going on. One is, how would we know, how would an interviewer interviewing a student know that their concept is more scientific than it was before? But the more basic one that I really hope to look at when I wrote this paper is two people could each have their own different ideas. How would they find out that they're actually agreeing on a new idea that neither of them had before? So I let's just take as given that Carol and Dana are both evolving their knowledge of physics right here. So they're both changing their knowledge, but they can't see into each other's head. How do they know, how does Carol know that Dana's change is like her change? And how does Dana know that Carol's change is like Carol's change, is like her change? How do they know if they're just not, and there could be an absurdist view where people are laughing and smiling and nodding at each other, but actually they don't understand anything that the other person is saying. They're just being happy together. So what's evidence for Carol that Dana is not just being smiley and happy, but Dana is actually shifting her ideas to be more like Carol's. And what's Dana's evidence? That Carol is shifting her ideas to be more like hers. That's the assignment to think about. Okay, there don't seem to be further questions, so I'll give you 4 or 5 minutes. I really think a close reading is a good idea, so that I would encourage each group not to think in general, but to find a piece of dialogue in here where they think either Carol or Dana has a good reason to believe the other student is starting to have knowledge just like theirs. We'll give you a few minutes to do that. I'm going to go get myself a cup of water. So this is sort of a 2-minute warning, and I'll be back in 2 minutes. Okay, I'm back, so I think we should talk. So what would be great is if we'd again queue up at different locations who might like to share some of what they've been talking about. Great.
We were looking at the brief piece of conversation on page 247. And what seemed to evolve from that is that there are like phases of restating the idea and confirming the idea. For example, like first Dana, first Caroline puts this idea in the second line, and then Dana kind of restates it in her own words and confirms it, and Caroline confirms that idea, and then Dana again supplements that idea with some more specifications and more details, and Caroline adds to that. So there's this like interchange of restating the idea and confirming between these two participants, and that seems to like convey the idea that they are building upon each other's idea and understanding each other's idea.
So where I was looking at what was the conversation on 252, where there are several times repeated what so Dana repeated what Carol said, and the other way around until they really found that they are sure that the other person really did in a way paraphrase or something what was said before. I mean, in the end we can't be sure, maybe there won't be an end, but I think that's there's really incidents of that.
The first one.
All right, so we're on. Elaine, you're up.
Oh, hi. So we were looking at the transcripts sort of at the end, kind of lines 50 and on, and how the two students are sort of reconstructing their process and their knowledge with the interviewer. So specifically how they were representing their shared knowledge at that point. And how, especially how they traded back and forth, as some of the other participants have talked about. Here is sort of the revoicing of shared knowledge, as well as we were looking at pronoun use.
Yeah, so the first time that they refer to themselves, in this transcript, that they refer to themselves as we is in episode 4, line 35, where they're talking about the repair of a divergence. And Carol starts right off the bat with we, and then we shows up in all the subsequent transcripts.
So they moved kind of from individual I and you to then a shared construction of knowledge.
Those are all terrific. So restating something, there's obviously a sense of solidarity in we. Another thing that is in the joint problem space work with Stephanie Teasley, and you can see it here as well, is finishing each other's thoughts, where somebody begins a thought and then the other person finishes it. And if that's not repaired, that feels to me to be very strong evidence that the ability to complete each other's thoughts successfully seems to be important. Does anyone else want to join in that? I'm enjoying the things you're pulling out. One thing I also want to draw attention to that was, I remember writing this at the time, was just pointing out that even at the end of this, that there was still a gap between their knowledge and scientific knowledge, in that they couldn't analyze what happens when you throw a ball up in the air. And that's on page 263. And what I remember at the time is, like, should I put that in there? Because, I mean, it kind of shows that it didn't fully work. And maybe I should leave that out. And in the end, I decided it was really an important part of the story. But, you know, of course, these students are constructing something themselves. how could it be the perfect approximation in such a short time of what physicists do? And so I thought it was important to put it in there. And that occurred in the interview with me, where I would ask them about a new situation. So of course, transfer is a way we test for other people's understanding. Do we both agree when we shift to a new, when we shift to a new setting? Okay, does anyone else want to jump in there?
Hi, we were just, we've been looking at data in one of our after-school program sites, and we were discovering something that I think is salient to the conversation. We're thinking about the ways that a group working together with a mentor present didn't necessarily surface a lot of dialogue about what they were doing and necessarily have a lot of opportunities to correct and check for understanding in dialogue. But the introduction of, say, myself as the researcher or a mentor that was working with a different group created a performance space that allowed the students where they, I feel like they felt they were, they had to articulate themselves in a different way and explain sort of in a meta-narrative sense, here's what we noticed, here's what we did, here are the steps that we followed, which actually I think is something we're going to look at in terms of design. So intentionally having mentors switch around and move to a group that they didn't work with intentionally. And this, we saw this in the piece of the paper where X comes in, and we're wondering what impact that might have had on C and D's work together.
Yeah, that all sounds, you know, very relevant to me and very related. Does anyone else want to share a thought? Right, so, you know, and I agree, and then, you know, a further question I think to think about is we talked, someone in the German setting, I believe, LMU, raised the point of there's two levels going on. There's science, the gap between this and science, and then there's the potential gap between Carol and Dana. So, you know, a further thing to think about is, are the standards of evidence Carol and Dana use with each other similar to or different from the ones the interviewer uses to try to figure out if they're understanding each other? How different are the social practices of evaluating a peer's understanding from the social practices of an authority trying to assess a newcomer's understanding? And also the practice dimension of this, of what does it take to become good at doing those things that give us evidence that, because I think that's valued in today's world, well, it's valued in our work at SRI a lot, the idea that you can arrive at a deeply shared meaning about difficult, abstract things is, you know, it's core to everything we do in our own work. And so how do people become good at that? And what is it that they're becoming good at when they're able to do that is really, I think, still core topics. Okay, does anyone want to jump in on this particular one with some more thoughts? If not, I thought I'd move on to part three. So queue up if you want to say more right here. Okay, so part three, I wanted to talk about this paper as a bit of rhetoric, as a kind of writing, and some of the challenges that were there for me, and some of what we could learn about it, you know, learn from this now in that way. And I bring this up because another hat I wear is I'm an associate editor for the Journal of the Learning Sciences. And so I see papers come in, and it's my role to take the reviews and give advice to the authors about how to improve their paper. This paper was an absolute disaster when I first sent it in. And I was, I think like often happens, I was swimming with very difficult jargony ideas from all the people at Berkeley and all the people at Stanford, at IRL, who were talking in these new ways about what they were seeing in data. And they were all using new and different terminology to describe what they were seeing. And the first draft of this paper, I think, was, you know, impenetrable to anyone but myself, who, you know, it was clicking for me, but, and in my mind it was starting to make sense, but it wasn't working to communicate to anyone else. But I sent it in because I didn't realize that. I thought I had figured it out. And really, I actually represented like 2 years of work to get to the point where I thought I understood it and how it was coming together, because I was doing my dissertation, I was going to IRL, I was working with Stephanie Teasley, and this was the final piece of all of that, of putting those things all together. And so I felt I had accomplished something, but when I sent it in, the reviews were absolutely terrible. Certainly revise and resubmit, and it was harsh, and it was hard to take. I had to read those reviews and put them down, go out and have a beer, maybe wait a day, look at it again, nope, still too hard to look at, have another beer, come back a third day, and then finally maybe I could settle down and read the reviews, because they were really harsh. And I was just, I just asked Janet Kolodner, who is the editor at that time, if she wanted to participate in this call, and she couldn't do it, but she wrote me a little note. I wanted to read it to you, so we can find it here. Janet. Well, if I can't find it quickly, I won't. Here it is. Give Kurt Van Lane lots of credit. This is Janet speaking as editor. My impression was that he helped me more than I helped you. Lasting 20 years is a neat thing, she says. But anyway, Janet was incredibly patient with me. She really believed in this article, that there was something there, and she was going to give me another chance. And but I had to get rid of 90% of the jargon and really pick the parts that were most important and really make an argument, is another thing she said. You can't just describe a lot of stuff in fancy terminology. You have to make a case for something. And so I then had to work really, really hard. I felt compelled that I had learned something and I wanted to get it out there, but I understood it was not working for people. And so I had to work really, really hard to think about how to make the rhetoric work. And I think one of the key things for me, and really that makes this paper good, I think, reflecting on why it's lasted so long, is on page 238, the framing of it as a puzzle that I'm trying to figure out. I think that gives the reader a hook to hang on to, and it's almost like a movie where you want to know how it ends because there's something to be resolved and you know what the author is trying to resolve. And so you'll see that the paper is framed as a puzzle that I'm trying to work on, and then everything I'm doing in the paper is to try to help move that puzzle along. And the puzzle is, by the end of the story, we jump to the end. It's like a movie again. We jump to the end and jump back in time. By the end, there's good evidence that they changed their idea, number one, and there's good evidence, number two, that they did it together and they agreed. But if you look at any little bit of dialogue, it's really hard to see how they could have done that because their language is so hard to follow, and it's so vague and it's so abstract and it's so ambiguous. How could that possibly happen? How could two people talking like this end up accomplishing something? And so that's why it's called a puzzling accomplishment. And when I write editorial letters these days, I find myself often critiquing papers that I call, in contrast, a tour through the zoo. And what I mean by that is I assume everyone in their life has gone to a zoo. And maybe you've gone to a zoo with a tour guide or with a parent. And there's a tendency when you go to the zoo for the conversation to go like that. Oh, over here we have a zebra. A zebra has black and white stripes. Now let's go to the ape cage. Oh, by the way, monkeys like bananas. Now let's go over here to the lion cage. Oh, they're very dangerous. Don't get too close. And so what the tour from the zoo is saying it's going through a narrative experience and giving one interesting fact or one interesting description of what you're seeing at each stop in the way. But when you're done with that tour through the zoo, you probably haven't learned much about animals in general. You've just called out features that you've seen, and there's a tendency in conversation analysis work for papers to come out that way as the tour through the zoo, where people are describing, over here I see this in the discourse, then the next piece of discourse I see that, and the third piece of discourse I see that. But for the reader not to know why those three separate things you saw add up to something. And so that's what the puzzle did for me, is now everything I was describing wasn't just a neat feature of discourse I saw, it had to somehow relate back to the puzzling accomplishment, the puzzle I'm trying to work out. So I hope that that's helping you see that piece of the rhetoric. And the second part I'd like to talk briefly about is towards the end, where I added a section that was not in the original paper at all, called Evaluation of the Claims. And that's on page 263, 264, 265. It goes on for quite a while. And this was something that Janet recommended, is state your claims, what are your hypotheses, show the evidence, and then evaluate to what extent does that evidence help you make an argument for those claims. And this was part of my struggle to say, this really is real. It really has clicked. This really does make sense. Here's the evidence. So here's the claim I'm making. I walked through the story of the dialogue, but now let's evaluate those claims. And we know how to do this in quantitative research for sure, where you test your theory and you have some data and you come back and you evaluate. And this was a way I tried to do it in qualitative data here that I think is part of what makes, to me, makes the paper work. And so I guess I'd like to pause there and see if, and we won't do the talk about part because we're running shorter on time, but are there any other things that occur to the audience that are things that you felt made this paper work well as a piece of rhetoric, as a piece of convincing somebody of something?
Jeremy, thanks for kind of opening up both the substance and kind of the kind of rhetoric level of the paper. You know, one thing, so I've taught the kind of the paper several times in different classes over the years, and one of the things that is always striking to me, because we pull from different kinds of traditions in our College of Ed, and so the students that show up out of ed tech, more traditional pathways, are completely blown away by the level of detail around, like, and at some level don't understand the level of detail around the talk and cognition that's kind of documented, because it's kind of a genre buster for them to kind of think about kind of ed tech work in that way. But I think for other people in the room, it is the very careful micro, you know, interaction work that helps actually substantiate the claims, right? And so I'd be interested just to know how the paper has traveled kind of across different communities, because it is kind of a blurred genre piece of wanting to talk about technology and collaboration at some level, but then also wanting to document conceptual change through the social process. And like, has that shaped how that paper has been taken up by different communities?
Yeah, and I don't have an overview of that to tell you. I will say that I did, just before we started, asked Frank to, asked Frank to put up on Dropbox another piece of this work, which was the more design-oriented aspect. So there was another paper I wrote, which is much more obscure because it was published in an obscure place. that was about design and what I learned about design by doing this work. And that would probably appeal more to the ed tech guys. And then there was, you know, versions of this work that were more about, really just back about conceptual change. There was a paper with Jack Smith and Andy DeSessa about misconceptions that was influenced by what went on here. So one answer to your question maybe is I ended up writing different pieces for different audiences based on aspects of what I had come to learn. Okay, I want to mention one other thing. Feel free to jump in, by the way. I'm going to go on and say one more thing about the rhetoric, because it fits advice I often give as an editor, and I think it's somewhat present in this paper. But if you have some other thing you want to add, anyone, just raise your hand at this point. Feel free to interrupt me. As an editor, one of the things I often advise people is that a paper should have a kind of U or V-shaped structure. And the reason why I use that idea is to say that the introduction should match the conclusion, and the literature review should match the discussion, and in the middle you have the body of the paper. And further, what I mean by that is an introduction, the most powerful introductions start with very general issues in the field that anyone could find interesting and important, but not your specific data. It's the general issue in the field that you're trying to call people's attention to. And to my taste, a good conclusion should return to that level of generality and say, now, not about the specific envisioning machine or these specific two kids, what have we learned about collaborative learning? And so, you know, this sets out a very general project at the beginning of the paper and makes a proposal at a very general level that the project is to understand conceptual change from collaborative interaction, and that the crux of that is going to be figuring out how convergence works. And then the conclusion, to some degree, does return to that level of generality. And then you can also see in this paper the matching at the next level, where then I lay out, it's not broken into a literature review, I see, but starting about in the middle of page 236, it really is starting to be a literature review that talks about the specific tools that I'm going to use to analyze this work. And then in the discussion, it kind of relates back to some of those tools and how they played out here. And then in the middle, you have the puzzling accomplishment through the evaluation of the claims. And so that's just something I'd offer to all the people in, you know, in the room who are working with, actually anywhere in the learning sciences, it doesn't matter qualitative or quantitative. I think your writing will work better in a journal like JLS if you think about that structure of trying to, you know, very general, very broad ways you're trying to solve a problem for the community, then the more specific tools you're going to use and your discussion of how those played out, and in the middle of your paper, really the body of the work from something you're trying to analyze to the evaluation of the evidence. Anyway, there's more to look at in any paper you read, and it's something you can do as you read papers, both to look at them for what they contribute, but also how they do their work as a piece of as a contribution. How did the paper make that contribution happen? And I think it's important to study and learn from. I still do it in my work. We recently won a big proposal at SRI, and in order to write the winning proposal, we studied five similar proposals to try to figure out how they worked. How did they convince the reviewers? And we took all the lessons we learned from that to write a rhetorically better proposal than we had before. Okay, so the final thing I want to talk about, I think we only have 5 minutes left. Is that right, Frank? Yeah, 10 minutes left. Okay. We have 10 minutes left. And the last segment four was going to be, okay, this was 20 years ago. Where are we today? Frank wants to say something.
I just wanted to point out that we have about 10 minutes because we started a bit late. And maybe we should also have a couple of minutes for some other questions that that participants had already before the meeting. We collected a couple of questions, for example, in the master's program here at LMU. And I have two or three questions that we ask all our presenters more on the relation of learning sciences and CSCL and so on. But maybe if we have a couple of minutes for open questions of the audience, of the participants, that would leave you like 5 or 6 minutes.
Yeah, let's do that right now. Let's hear the open questions. I'm more interested in your questions than what I have to say. So let's hear your questions. And then if there's time left, I'll close with a few remarks about how this fits in today. So over to you for questions.
But as I have collected these couple of questions, because the master's students are sitting there in preparing for that session, they wrote a couple of comments and questions. I found them especially good, some of them, and so maybe we can hear them right now, and then I will follow with my questions. Or maybe also the other sites, Washington, Utah, Chicago, would have questions.
Hi, I'm Heather here at LMU, and my question was actually kind of regarding what you started to say anyway, and was that this paper was published about 20 years ago, and I just wondered kind of how this could apply in a situation now where we've come so far that these students are sometimes completing similar tasks, but there's no face-to-face interaction anymore, and how can we apply this sort of framework that you've come up with no gestures and sometimes even no verbal interaction as you had in your paper?
Yes, I it's a great question, and I think the main thing is to realize how hard that is, that face-to-face communication in front of a screen together has so many more resources available than many of other of the communication modalities that are possible or even common today. There's a group with me at SRI who is doing a lot of studies of online or blended learning, and one of the worrisome findings broadly in the field is an increasing of the gap from low achieving students to high achieving students. With MOOCs or some of these other things, you sometimes find people who are extraordinarily well prepared to learn can do well in this very difficult and abstract environment, but the struggling students have a really hard time and often drop out of the course or are further turned off. So at the very least, there's a basis here for a critique of the potential of some of these online environments, or if critique's not the right word, a strong note of caution that we may be asking people to learn in very difficult environments, and maybe we shouldn't be quite so optimistic about that. The third thing I'd say is, of course, we can look for ways, we don't exactly have gesture, but to bring in pointing, for example, and other gesture-like behaviors to try to replicate some of these capabilities, to try to create a richer environment that's closer to all the resources of face-to-face interaction. So I hope that helps with your question, and why don't we take another?
So maybe I summarize two of the other issues, or no, let's say comments. And I also asked that other presenters, maybe I go first, and then Washington will ask next question, and maybe Jeremy, if there is time to answer my question after the Washington question, that that would be good. I think the technology question, your research is a very good example of that, a paper on a piece of technology. Not sure if they would have been labeled, if this would have been labeled a micro world or a simulation then in the 90s. It was a specific type of technology that was, I think, typically used then. You used it and in your studies, and your study is still very often cited and used in courses, used at in discussions as a reference. So obviously you chose a piece of technology that is not that was not so relevant for your research, or that is at least not has not been outdated at a certain point. So what would be your recommendation for PhD students selecting the technology and well, situating that technology in their overall research in such a way that the research is not outdated once the papers are written and the dissertation is submitted?
Hi, we were wondering, we read for a sociolinguistics seminar a paper sort of reanalyzing your data, so this Koshman and Zemel 2009, also in JLS, and sort of reexamining the work alongside discourse between scientists as they make a discovery. So just wondering if, well, I guess, A, if you were familiar with this paper, and sort of what you thought of the moves that they did in this work to look at the students that you studied in parallel to scientists making a discovery.
Great. So let me do the questions in order. You know, so the technology, of course, the literal technology of the envisioning machine did become rapidly outdated, and it doesn't really exist anymore. And I moved on in my career to mathematics education, but still looking at dynamic representations. And so I do think in learning sciences research, there are certain connections between technology and cognition that do persist and are a good basis for the work that people are going to do. And it would be good to pick a technology in a dissertation or a big piece of work you're going to do that you have a reason to believe there's a really deep connection to how people learn within that. And so dynamic representations, I've moved on to SimCalc. We just had a wonderful talk yesterday by Cliff Canold, who was taking the framing of games a bit more, but in spirit, he was teaching data analysis, so a different topic, but in spirit, I think his technology was just like the envisioning machine of creating an interactive environment with good representations that would facilitate coming to an understanding. So, of course, dynamic representations is not the only possibility, but I would just advise people to look for that deeper link, that deeper linkage of the technology to learning, and not dwell on the popular conception, perhaps, of what the technology is as a way to do that. Certainly in Silicon Valley, you know, the popular thing at the moment is all sort of in the area of personalization. I would be very wary about framing a dissertation in terms of personalization, because not because there may not be a good idea there, but because it's such a broad and ambiguous term that means so many different things to so many different people, that years later the term may have shifted a lot in what it means. And I do think, I'll just say this now as part of, this fits into why this work is relevant, but I'm just upon it. I think one reason that collaborative learning is really relevant now is so much of the popular sense of educational technology is really pointing towards individualization, that we can figure out what individual learners might need and intervene just for that person. And I think, I still believe in collaborative learning and believe that it's perhaps a yet even more powerful process than individualization, or at least a very complementary process. And so I think broadly, the world needs lots of smart people doing collaborative learning right now, because personalization or individualization is being a bit overdone, perhaps. Okay, the second question was about the Koshman work. And so I supported Tim in doing that. I gave him access to my videotapes and everything. And I certainly reviewed it at the time, and I thought it was all good. I actually haven't read it in a long time, so I don't feel I can make a really sharp comment on how I feel about that work, other than to say, you know, I do think, you know, at the broadest sense, learning is about a society trying to enculturate its next generation. And so I think the dialectic between here's what learners do when investigating a scientific phenomena, and here's what scientists do, is really important to try to find those correct parallels that will reproduce what we value most in our society, and also will be most innovative for the society. That's why we all care so much about learning. It's in that broad interaction between what's going on today that's really culturally valued and what's in the promise of what kids do. And I think often we get the wrong abstraction. I feel this in mathematics education a lot now, that people have, for example, decided on fractions as being incredibly important. But in the real world, most practicing people use decimals more. And it's actually kind of easier to understand decimals than fractions. And so is this topic really important anymore, of fractions? You know, do we need to learn long division anymore? We all agree that one we don't need. And so I think that tension, that's a very broad way of responding to the question about Koshman, but I do think society needs to inquire into what its senior people do well and what's important there, and what kids do well and how those two relate.
Thanks for these great answers. So one question that we also ask all of our guests here is the question of the relation of CSCL and the learning sciences. So what do you see as a specific contribution or role of computer-supported collaborative learning and that community in for the learning sciences? How do the two relate? So we were even discussing earlier with Chris Hoadley the question, is learning sciences developing towards being a discipline, and what is the role of CSCL in that development, if this is developing at all in the direction? So we had quite different opinions about that.
Right. I think it goes back to the initial question of, do we value the social outcomes of being able to share ideas with other people, share difficult and hard ideas? At the time I wrote this paper in the early 90s, we didn't yet talk much about 21st century skills. But I think it's really shifted in 20 years to society more explicitly valuing collaboration. And so at one level, a learning sciences without collaborative learning just is kind of irrelevant to where society is moving, because society cares about collaboration so much now. And there's obvious reasons all around us why that has to be. The complexity of what we're trying to do as a society almost always involves teamwork these days. And teamwork on deep ideas is important. So I think the learning sciences has to include collaborative learning. Just as it's very important in the learning sciences now, desire to incorporate more about emotions, motivation, self-regulation, and other things that were not in our focus 20 years ago, I think is another dimension that must be added beyond some of the cognitive roots of the learning sciences. And you know, this plays out differently across the world, but I think it's great that we have conferences and that CSCL is part of the learning sciences. I think is just critical. And then I think I do think we're at a time where it's really important for us to communicate beyond our academic community, that with MOOCs becoming a big phenomena, but also a lot of what's going on in K-12 schooling with iPads and other technology, I see collaborative learning as still something we really need to help teachers and students with, both because it's a great way to learn content. I don't have it to wave at now. I just saw another meta-analysis that came out of how effective collaborative learning is. Forget the shared knowledge part, just as improving individuals. There's lots of great data that it's effective. And then the importance of learning to collaborate as what something we want kids to do. John Bransford has the great phrase of sequestered problem solvers, meaning problem solvers isolated from the world. And that's not what we want. We don't want kids that are only able to solve in isolation. We want people who can work together. So that's where I would end, and I think this work is really relevant. The special issue on CSCL that just came out, which Frank has a terrific article in, you know, is an example of how this field keeps moving and growing. And so much has happened since we wrote this, since I wrote this paper. So I think the field also should keep going, because the rate of progress is amazing as a scientific discipline. And look what's happened since IJCSCL was launched, and it quickly rose to become one of the top journals in education at all, and one of the hardest journals to get into. So I just think the time is really right for yet more and more work on collaborative learning.
Okay, thanks a lot for these elaborations on that important topic for us all. Maybe we have a very quick round of final words from every side. Let me start. I think that was an excellent talk. It was great to hear the history of ideas and how they co-developed into your paper and to the concept of convergent conceptual change. And for me, it was also great to have you as a model showing how to work with this paper and maybe also similar paper in our own teaching. I think that was an excellent example that you gave us here. I specifically like your tour through the Sioux metaphor for the editorial process, but maybe I give the floor to the others to say a couple of words as final words. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you for the suggestions on writing good papers. I think they are very useful because we haven't thought to connect introduction with conclusion, connect the theory with discussion, and we find it is very useful. We are currently working on a paper, and this would help us a lot. Really, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
So thank you very much for this very interesting lecture and sharing all your knowledge with us and answering the questions of the master's students. And the next time you feel like you need a beer, you might consider to come over to Bavaria. We have some very special beer here.
That's properly strong, not American beer.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, thank you so much for this talk. As we said in the chat, especially hearing about the legacy of this work and then hearing about publishing was really useful, I think, for the PhD students in the room.
It's always super helpful also to get this sort of 10,000-foot view of the field and then to dive deeply into a particular paper or hearing about a particular scholar's work. That contrast is always super helpful. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy, for talking especially about the rhetoric. That was very useful, and the way you have organized your thoughts in the paper and the way the paper was shaped. This was really helpful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Jeremy, from my side too. It was a great talk. I think I learned a lot. Thank you very much.
Okay, maybe Jeremy, final words, and then we close down that session. Thanks everyone for participating. Great contributions and questions, answers. Bye-bye to everyone.
Oh, I really enjoyed the time as well. Thanks for being thoughtful and really reading the paper and for great questions. Any of you can feel free to write me email if you ever have a follow-up. And if you catch me at a conference, I actually enjoy talking to people about careers and how careers evolve, which is one of the reasons I included that in here. And I wish that at the time, I had more people who would talk to me at careers. So I'm always happy to do that. Also, write articles for JLS. It still tries to stick to this tradition of being a very supportive place for people who really have an idea that they're trying to get out. We allow lots and lots of revisions if it's going to result in a really great contribution. So consider it as a place to publish your work. And I just wish all of you great luck in pursuing your careers. And when you have that big idea, it may take a couple years. So work, persist, don't give up. And eventually you might end up with a paper that lasts a long time, or a piece of software, or a curricular practice, or whatever it is you're inventing. If you keep at it, you might end up with something that really lasts. It can happen. Bye, everyone.